A view of paradise both before and after the campfire. On Insight today, journalist Mark Arax traces the long history of the town of Paradise from the gold mining era through the area's agricultural and urban growth, with a look at the politics that were influential and even the earliest firefighting approaches. He explores circumstances that led up to last November. He calls them a myriad of factors that lined up in perfect continuity. Mark's piece is in the August 2019 issue of the California Sunday Magazine. It's titled Gone. Today, you'll hear our extended conversation. Then, an encore broadcast of our segment with Sacramento artist Stephanie Taylor. She created an art project, a book, and an exhibit with Paradise resident Christy Heron Smith, whose family homes were destroyed in that fire. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. The town of Paradise continues to rebuild after being nearly destroyed in the campfire in November of 2018. A story published in the August 2019 California Sunday Magazine shows pictures of painfully scorched areas with big letters across the page that spell the word gone. The words underneath say, decades of greed, neglect, corruption, and bad politics led to last year's Paradise Fire, the worst in California's history. It should never have happened. That article was written by journalist and author Mark Arax, and we talked by phone recently.
By the time I made it to Paradise, this deadliest fire in California history was 4 months past. I was driving up this burned-out ridge between these two river canyons, and it was pouring rain. And I had never been to Paradise before. I went up there with this notion that, well, they built a little community up here where the foothills give way to the forest. But it wasn't a little community. On a perch of volcanic red earth, they had grown a city, a suburbia. What to call the experiment? If you counted the sprawl up the mountain that followed the original sprawl on the hill, 40,000 people had lived atop a geologic chimney.
Did you go in with a frame or an attitude about the story? You'd read the headlines. By the time you got there, the PG&E discussion and the pointing of fingers was already well underway. What was your view going in?
I kind of went in, it was almost like someone going a corner, looking at a body, a dead body. Here's this place that's gone. And you're trying to figure out what were the factors that led to that tragedy. So I had a sense, going up that there were several things, circumstances, some incidental, some accidental, some malevolent forces that lined up in this kind of perfect continuity that allowed this tragedy to happen. And I was trying to puzzle those out and then flesh them out as well. And the people, their existence atop that ridge, they knew that it courted danger, but they chose to forget about the last drought, the last flood, the last wildfire. And it was funny because they didn't name themselves a city. They, I think, self-consciously said they were building a town up there. The town of Paradise, the town with the future was the slogan. So, there was tragedy and irony right there side by side. As much as I tried to convey what that place looks like, it was empty now, but it was filled up. Scorched trees, felled trees, burnt shells of cars, melted piles of twisted corrugated tin, ashes of businesses, ashes of houses, ashes of people. It had become its own new place. But as much as you tried with words, it's not until you go up there and see it that you have a sense of the devastation, the ravage that the fire did.
Before we go into what I think is the core and actually the power of this piece, which is a walk back in time through all the forces that created it, I do want to mention that you had a guide initially, a young woman named Joan. She and her family didn't lose their house, but there were six homes in her extended family that were gone. And you say to her at one point, Did fire come to paradise, or did paradise go to the fire? And you sort of retracted that question then, wondering whether it was unfair or callous. I read that as a real key question for you, Mark. So can we expand there for a moment before we back up in time?
That is the key question. That's the question that takes you through this piece. What was callous about it was, I think, asking her to answer that. You know, there was a kind of facile either or to it. And to someone still absorbing, and she was still absorbing after 4 months, the dimensions of what had taken place there, I don't think it was fair to ask her of that. So as she struggled to answer it, it's a simple question. Did fire come to paradise, or did paradise go to the fire? But it's not so simple to answer. It was my question to answer. And so almost as soon as I asked it, I retracted it. I brushed it away. And that's what the piece becomes. It's a journey to understand and answer that question.
So, Mark, now we go back to 1859 and a time when, as you write, all the easy gold had been fished out of the Feather and Butte. And this is where you set the beginning of the story that leads up to the campfire in November of 2018. Why go back that far?
Well, that's where it begins. That's where the industrialization of that ridge starts. The easy gold had been fished out. Hydraulic mining, you know, the bending of water into flumes and then pressurizing it through hoses with nozzles. That began, and that whole thing was controlled by the industrialists who lived on San Francisco's Knob Hill, and they erected this sprawling system to capture and convey the water. And then at some point, mining ended, and lumber was the new gold. And by 1902, the Diamond Match Company had purchased 55,000 acres on the ridge, and they built in this big sawmill that sent the lumber down to Chico. You know, Chico and Paradise, they're almost sister communities. They're separated by that skyway. And way back in the early 1900s, the lumber was harvested up in the ridge and beyond, and then that came down to Chico where these matches were made. And at some point, the ridge ended up doing what a lot of places do before they become suburban communities, is they farm. They planted 12,000 acres of pears, walnuts, olives, grapes. They had these special apples. They made this organic apple juice way back when that was prized throughout the state. And you just see the slow growth happening first through the industrialization of the forest. And by the mid-50s, the Skyway, that road, the one road that connects Chico and Paradise, it had been paved and expanded. The number of businesses had grown by 50% in a 6-year span, and the population by 1953 was 10,000. And there were a large contingent of Mormons and Seventh-day Adventists who moved up there. You know, the forests were California's new frontier. This kind of place to celebrate what I call the Western itch of reinvention and forever expansion. And so this boom was on, and neither the state nor the county dared to dictate to Paradise what it should or shouldn't be. And that's where you start seeing this untrammeled growth happen.
Mark, let me add a couple pieces in there from your article. You were talking about the farming, and the settlers had created the Paradise Irrigation District in 1916. But even before that was the brand new then Pacific Gas and Electric. It had formed in 1905 and ended up buying the dam and reservoir that the people had built, so a distribution system was connected. I found fascinating to be reminded of the fact that these pieces were put in place so long ago. And then you fast forward to things like the 50s and the Skyway. And the idea the whole time, according to someone else that you talked to, a reporter at the time, was grow, 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 don't stop, nobody warning anybody in the midst of this housing boom that there could be a wildfire, that it all could go up in flame and smoke, that everything was looking ahead to the urbanization.
That's right. I mean, so you see the fingerprint, if not more, of PG&E back in the early 1900s. They're already gaining a reputation as kind of a, a water-sucking serpent, and they go up there and they make a play for the ridge's power, and they end up controlling it like they do, you know, all throughout northern and central California eventually. Yeah, one of the first voices, one of the first people who starts to help me document what took place up there, the growth, the irresponsible growth, is a woman named Pam Figge. Pam was first started off as a reporter at the Weekly Ridge Gazette. Then she became an actual town planner, and then finally a land use professor at Chico State. In those go-go years, the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, I mean, she couldn't recall a fire official from the state or the county ever publicly warning these ridge communities, Paradise and the other ones that were growing, that a housing boom in the middle of wildfire country was risking, you know, not just property, but lives. And she started telling, you know, I said, well, how did this happen? Give me a sense of what was going on the ground. And she talked about this process. She called it 4x4ing. I never heard of that before.
I didn't know that 4x4ing had to do with development.
Yeah.
And growth of neighborhoods and communities.
She wasn't sure what it meant when she first heard it either. But basically, a businessman in town with some influence would buy a parcel in Paradise. And back then, there was not a town council. The Board of Supervisors, the Butte County Board of Supervisors, controlled growth and so much else in Paradise. So a businessman buys a parcel in Paradise. The supervisors promptly agree to his request to divide the parcel into four pieces. Then he takes one of those four pieces and he sells it to a friend, a family member, a partner, who then goes before the same board and wins approval to divide his piece into four. On and on, this kind of 4x4 slicing happens. And the number four isn't arbitrary. I mean, had they split each piece into five, it would have qualified as a subdivision under state law, and that would have required the developers and the residents to then fund the proper infrastructure and follow state law. They didn't have to do it when they were 4x4ing. And scores of housing tracts pop up without sidewalks, gutters, buffers to provide a defensible space against fire. Roads come later. Sometimes they don't come at all. A municipal sewage system is never constructed. It's all septic tanks made of concrete, and sometimes nothing more than redwood planks covering a hole filled with gravel.
I'm talking with Mark Arax. He is a journalist whose pieces in the California Sunday magazine have been featured on Insight in the past. He has written extensively about water, water politics, and water history in California. And he is author of the new and best-selling book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. There's a lot of your book, especially the end of your book, that ties into the story that you saw play out, or at least into a lot of this history in the area of Paradise in Butte County.
Yeah, the book is about the invention and the reinventions of California and how we as a people ended up changing a landscape more than any society had ever changed a landscape physically. And that change happened in a dramatic fashion on the valley floor, the entire Central Valley, from the Sacramento to Bakersfield and beyond. And then that change also took place in a dramatic alterations of the forest watersheds and the natural fire cycles, the same kind of dramatic change. And we're paying the price for those alterations today in a way that we never have.
Growth and development is only one part of the story. The other critical part that you write deeply about is what happens to the forest. Say something about a man you spent time with, Richard Wilson. I think his initial credential is that he's an old cattleman.
Right. So I go deep into the woodlands with this book called Fire in Sierra Nevada Forests. And it's really a remarkable book. It has these photos that date back as far as the 1840s. And they depict these great swaths of the Sierra with only a scattering of trees. And the forest looks kind of forlorn. And then, you know, you look a century and a half later and these same locations reveal this entirely different Sierra. You know, a forest that supported back in pre-settlement times 64 trees an acre now boasts 160 trees an acre. And you know, we all look at that and say, wow, this border-to-border, mountain-to-mountain vegetation is proof of the forest's good health. But it's not. That's not the way the landscape was intended to be. And it was Richard Wilson, who I found deep in the on his own mountain, Buck Mountain, an old cattleman, who ran the California Department of Forestry and Fire in the 1990s when Pete Wilson was our governor. And he becomes like my John Muir, kind of a heretic on the mountain, but also this oracle who really explains to me the second piece of this. It's the human footprint on that land and the growth that took place up there in a place that shouldn't have grown. And then it's the forests. And he explains how the Indians passed on to us a natural forest. Much of it was patchy, and the trees grew to these differing heights. And this combination of open ground and an uneven canopy kept the fires from raging. And you know, fire is a natural event in the healthy forest, he reminded me. And you know, it starts by lightning strike, and it usually burns itself out quickly. But before it does, it scorches the forest floor, thins out the lower branches and the shrubs, and that thinning out tames the next fire, and it also allows the new trees to generate. But the timber companies that came did not allow for those natural cycles, and our government didn't insist that they operate within those natural cycles. And so what replaced that naturalness was basically a kind of agriculture in the forest. We were planting trees one on top of the other, like a crop. And that growth was so uniform that when a fire hit, Richard said it became a blowtorch. The trees are nothing but matchsticks. And so we had turned our forest into easy kindling as well.
My conversation with journalist Mark Arax continues after a short break. His story about paradise and the campfire is in the August 2019 California Sunday Magazine. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Let's continue our conversation with Mark Arax, a journalist and author of The Dreamt Land. He wrote a new piece for the August 29 California Sunday Magazine titled Gone. And before the break, we were talking about Richard Wilson, the head of the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection in the 1990s. He had a very specific opinion about what's happened to California forests and how they've been managed.
He said that we had these unprecedented patterns of human settlement in areas that John Muir had called God's wildness. And these settlement patterns had resulted in perhaps the most rapid and massive disruption of natural fire cycles and watersheds ever experienced on Earth. That was his conclusion. And that when he took the job to head the California Department of Fire and Forestry, he sat down with Pete Wilson and they agreed to a couple things. I mean, he took that job because he felt that Wilson had a background in urban planning, the Governor Wilson, and that he was talking about managing suburban sprawl and bringing back a sustainable model of harvesting timber and waiting not 30 years to harvest, but every 60 to 80 years, waiting for those trees not to be, you know, 5 to 16 inches across, but 30 to 36 inches. And you would have these young and old trees properly spaced that would once again bring back that uneven canopy that would be a safeguard against big forest fires.
I just want to add that in here, there is a significant shift that happens in firefighting in California. The psychological view of it, the finances, the resources, and a power shift, too. And I think this is really pivotal.
It is. They're like four changes that take place on his watch. Governor Wilson does not go through with any of those reforms. And what happens is you see Cal Fire, beginning during Richard Wilson's time there, but really happening afterward, that it changes. It becomes Cal Fire. And the uniforms aren't the khaki uniforms of the old forestry day. Those are gone. It's a shift in colors to blue. And that shift from khaki to blue becomes a shift in missions. And the ranger soon finds himself a kind of second-class citizen in this department that he once commanded. And the services that the ranger performed, coordinating prescribed burns, protecting watersheds from the rack of clear cuts, reducing these fuel loads, those all became curtailed. And what you see is that the structuring of California firefighting becomes almost a disaster industrial complex. And we see the deification, as I call it, of these first responders. I mean, we never called them first responders. That's what they became known in the years after 9/11. And so we see this kind of warlike mobilization to fight these fires instead of trying to prevent them. And today, fire suppression is now a $1.1 billion line item in the department's budget.
Mark Arax is a journalist. He is the author of the best-selling book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. You can find links to past conversations with Mark about water and water policy in the state, as well as his Cap Radio Reads conversation with Donna Appadoni. Of course, now we come up more to the present, and PG&E is the pivotal figure in the most present and recent discussion and controversy. When you walked in to your own visit in Paradise, did you go in thinking you were telling a PG&E story?
I had a sense that PG&E was going to be a part of it. I did. So I don't know if you want to include this, but let me finish just one thought on the fire. What ended up happening at the end, which really disturbed Richard Wilson, was that as Cal Fire and the state of California never told those communities how to grow, because we have this whole idea in California, as much as we think we're a regulated state, the state has decided to let the locals decide not just how they use groundwater, but how they develop. And so as the suburbanization of the forest lands took place, Cal Fire started serving that suburbanization. They became the fire department to those growing suburbs, and they got revenue from that. So it was a very interesting partnership. They were keeping silent on something that they were profiting off of. So now we come to PG&E.
And I'll add to that that you say Richard Wilson said this became a moneymaker. This whole system was making money for everyone involved in firefighting.
That's right. It was. And so you see this this relationship, and I'm not saying that they kept quiet to get the revenue, but what happened was is the state of California and all its agencies decided not to have a voice in how the communities were growing up there, even though they knew that that growth was courting danger.
And this is Richard Wilson's contention.
That's right, Richard Wilson. And he's the perfect guy. I mean, he's lived in the forest most of his life. And when he came down that mountain, it was to head California Fire and Forest. So yes, this is his contention. Now we move on to the fourth part of this puzzle, and that's the role of PG&E. That spark started, right, somewhere. The kindling was there. The humans had made their suburbia there. And then we did not manage the forest in a way that we should have. So we had all that fuel. But now we needed to have a spark. And the spark has come time and again from PG&E. And so that section begins with some folks in Paradise recalling that on the evening before this fire, PG&E had sent out these short recorded messages telling people in the Ridge, telling people across eight counties, in fact, Butte and its sister counties, that they were going to shut off the power the next day in all likelihood because of these wind conditions, and this five-year drought had killed tens of millions of trees, and these were perfect wildfire conditions. So PG&E activates its emergency operations center, sends out all these phone calls and text messages, but it never turns off the power. And that is a question that haunts the folks up there. Why didn't this happen?
A judge at one point says in court, and it's part of recorded testimony, there is one very clear-cut pattern here, that PG&E is starting these fires. The drought did not start the fire. Global warming did not start the fire. PG&E started it. So what do we do? You've just mapped out a number of factors, and as you said in the very beginning of the story, some incidental, some accidental, others malevolent, all of it leading up to where we are today. In the way you lay it out, Mark, the PG&E chapter is one chapter. It's not the whole story.
That's right. It happens to be the longest chapter because I'm tracing this kind of criminal negligence, this culture inside PG&E. You know, I was talking to these handful of litigators from these three law firms in Northern California who represent close to 1,000 survivors. You know, when did they see this? They traced these historic blazes to this culture of mismanagement, corruption, and cover-up that had taken hold inside PG&E decades before. And they kept pointing me to all these previous fires, these gas mainline explosions. Two of them in particular said, to find the DNA of this tragedy in paradise, you have to go back to San Bruno, the tragedy that happened on September 9th, 2010, where that gas mainline blows and it takes an entire neighborhood with it, kills 8 people.
So Paradise was one, as you say, town on a ridge in California. But the landscape and the forest management stretches the state, as does this utility, PG&E. We are a state that burns, and we're coming off the heels of a cycle of dry weather, even though we had a very wet winter and some changing conditions. What questions did this raise for you about where to next? From the scope of the firefighting to urban management, it's such a big puzzle, Mark. What were you left thinking?
So we have our state's population is exploding in the very areas most susceptible to wildfires. I found these statistics stunning, that from 1990 to 2010, the number of houses built in the wildland-urban interface, in these woodlands and forests, it grew by 1 million houses in that 20-year span. The number of people rose by nearly 3 million. So today, one out of every 4 Californians, you know, 10 million people now live in the zone of wildfire. And they're scattered across Butte, Shasta, Contra Costa, Alameda, San Luis Obispo, but more than half reside in Los Angeles, Riverside, San Bernardino, Orange, and San Diego counties. So what's going to give? And this is the question at the heart of The Dreamt Land, my book, is the systems we built, these magnificent systems to move water from one end of the state to the other. They built 2, if not 3, world-class cities in this incredible farm belt in the middle, but it has these cracks, and something has to give. The system, the population of California in the life of that system has grown from 11 million to 40 million. How much more can we grow? You know, we're talking about building new houses now, new affordable houses. It's a very laudable goal. But into what safe zone are we going to put these houses?
So let's go back to your question. Did fire come to Paradise, or did Paradise go to the fire? We can expand that to a statewide question, but what do you think now?
It's a combination of both, but I think it's more so that Paradise went to fire. There was a defiance, a human defiance, a California defiance, a defiance that's rooted in our gold rush culture, you know, that supercharged way we began. It's a defiance that we just don't want to admit where we live, and we do not want to live with the constraints that we probably ought to respect if we want to, you know, mitigate all these disasters. So I think that Paradise went to fire in a big way.
If that's true, it's painful for the people today who paid, in some cases, with their lives, their property, loss of family members, for decisions and sins, perhaps, of people generations before them. It's a hard thing to talk about and a hard thing to look squarely at.
Chapter 5 of this piece is with someone who survived, you know, ran down the Skyway with her 7-year-old granddaughter, Kathy Pepys, and her granddaughter, Chloe. I mean, it was really a miracle that they had escaped. And I found her on the mountain. You know, she wants to rebuild the place that burned down, her house. And all her children are coming back to Paradise to build. She's moved into another house in the meantime there. And, you know, the question is how can this be? And she gives a really poignant answer, is that, you know, this is her home. She recalled the wedding of her son a few years ago. There was a reception at the church. The food, the music, the decorations, all of it was handled by friends and family. In fact, they built the dance floor right there in the parking lot. And from 7 in the morning to 11 at night, they didn't stop working. And she asked, how does my family find that kind of communal giving somewhere else? And so she knows the risk, the danger, and she hopes that in honor of those 85 who died, that the place is built smarter, smaller, metal roofs. She knows they're going to pay more in insurance. They should be paying much higher fees to the local government to actually build a community that's sustainable with real streets, real roads, you know, safe zones from fire. But she knows that the danger can never be fully taken out of the ridge, and that climate change is going to make life there even more of a gamble. And so as I say goodbye to her, I'm driving down the ridge into the Central Valley, you know, past that charred forest. And I'm skirting the Delta, and I'm thinking back to John Sutter, who in the midsummer of 1839, you know, the father of our California myth, right? He gets lost in those tules looking for the mouth of the Sacramento River. And when he finally finds the mouth of the river, he locates his new empire, the future state capital, in the embrace of not one river, but two, the worst floodplain in all of California. So we tend to forget that Sacramento is girdled by levees and erected on a 10-foot bed of borrowed earth.
Well, Mark, this conversation is testament that I don't think we'll ever be done talking about this fire, what it did, what led up to it. But I appreciate that you've given us a reason to explore even more of it. We're always glad to have you on Insight.
Thank you. I think it's an important story. We're going to see more of these fires. And just hope we can learn a lesson or two as they happen.
That was Mark Arax on his story Gone in the August 2019 California Sunday Magazine. We posted a link to it on our website. His recent book is titled The Dreamt Land, and you can find past segments with Mark at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Insight, celebrating its 15th year on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. People who survive wildfires often take different paths through their grieving and their healing process. For Christy Heron Clark, everyday items in the ashes of her house and her grandparents' house in Paradise became treasures. She joined artist Stephanie Taylor in looking carefully through what was left
And some of what they found became an art project, a book, and a powerful exhibit called Simple Objects, an Excavation. The exhibit was at the Archival Gallery in Sacramento in the summer of 2019. Stephanie Taylor joined me in the studio in June, and she started our conversation by reading from the book that accompanied the exhibit.
Visiting London in 2003, I saw an exhibition of artifacts found in the Thames River during construction of the Tate Modern. Created as a cabinet of curiosities, my memory of those shallow drawers full of categories such as buttons and toys persisted. When I listened to Christy Heron Clark, born and raised in Paradise, read an essay about her family who lost everything in the campfire, I asked her if she'd collaborate on simple objects, drawings and photography of everyday things. In January, Christy and I made the first of two trips to see what remained of the homes she grew up in. She wanted me to see Paradise, though of course I was too late. She wanted me to see a few areas that remained untouched, the lake where she and her dad fished, the graveyard, a place that she'd never visited, a place with grass and the promise of spring flowers, the only vertical elements in the landscape, gravestones, black tree trunks, and chimneys.
From the earliest conversations between the two of you, how did you decide it was okay to ask her if the objects from this very personal, devastating experience could become art, could become an exhibit that would be shared with everybody?
I don't know that it ever occurred to me to question whether it was okay. We had such a deep, sympathetic understanding that it just organically popped up.
Her family, we should say, got out of Paradise okay.
Yes, they did. They had to flee for their lives, and they made it.
So what were you looking for, or were you looking for anything in particular when you started walking through the ashes?
Well, it's such a process of coming to Paradise, a place I'd never visited, even though I was born in Chico. It's one of those places I always said, I need to go there. And that's why I wrote about it being too late. Of course, it is still there. We just wandered around first to get the setting, which is deeply, profoundly beautiful, and sits on this incredible ridge with these, like a mini canyon, like the Grand Canyon. And then we went to her homes right next to each other, the home her mother and father lived in where she grew up and her grandparents' home. And it's numbing for me. I watched Christy gingerly walk into the detritus. She had this long pole, and every once in a while she'd bend over and she'd pick something up and hold it up as a little treasure for me to see. And so we kind of went off on our two separate ways.
Christy is a science writer. Her articles have appeared in many publications. She has a statement in that same book that you just read from. I'm going to share a little bit of it. She writes, "In a pit of vaporized debris contained only by foundation walls, I was surprised how easy it was to find my way. The only things that remained semi-intact included ceramics and metals, materials that had already proven themselves once in the depth of flame. Here they persevered, inviting contemplation." Help everybody with the visual of the metals, the colors, the texture, the experience of what you found.
Well, it's a monochromatic landscape of ash, grays, whites to black, and basically the only color in the landscape is the color of the instantaneous rust and oxidation that occurs on the surface of metal.
I visited the exhibit yesterday, Stephanie, and that rust orange color is eerie because it's so present that in a way it makes the fire feel very alive. That color is still so organic and alert, even when it's just in a flat photograph.
It is, and we come to this project from two different veins, Christy and I. What we didn't feel we needed to do was talk about the day of the fire itself. She comes to each object with her memories, where they were in the house, what she was doing, what they meant to her, what they meant to her family. So she has that past. And I would pick up something from the ashes and address it as it exists now, the reality of this object that's covered in a different, altered, transformed state.
You're listening to artist Stephanie Taylor. She is talking about her multimedia collaboration with Christy Heron Clark. It's called Simple Objects, an Excavation. There's a collection of watches. There are burned rims of glasses. I think these are the things that could remind anybody of that drawer or that basket,
right,
the place where these things exist.
Yes, I'm very process-oriented, so to have the responsibility, take on the responsibility of archiving, categorizing, photographing each and every little tiny object was very profound for me. And to sit with these objects in my hands and look at them and try to best communicate how they are now was an amazing experience for me.
You write about a hammer being one object that twisted you up inside. So in that description, I found the interface between what someone else's experience in the fire was and that object and your own memories. And I think that that's a powerful result of this exhibit. You want to talk about the hammer a little bit?
Yeah, the hammer was this very small hammer head. It's no longer a hammer because, of course, the handle was wood and it's gone. And for some reason, this little item just resonated so deeply with me. I carried it around for days and days. And I'm a sculptor. And then it also referenced the hammer that I inherited from my father, which is unwieldy and archaic and paint spattered, and I can't get rid of it.
So the owner of Archival Gallery D told me that people are usually very quiet in the exhibit. That's not a surprise. And that people cry. I walked in the door, and the thing that grabbed me in the midst of the rust and the metal and the melted ceramic was the white ash, the soft white ash. Is there something that still, every time you look at it, grabs you in that way or in some way?
Well, since I write about the California environment, and this environment is changing, we have to look at these situations and look at the ash and the transformation and understand that we are transforming in this very moment from what we grew up with, what I grew up with, what my grandfather grew up with, to something new and seemingly much more dangerous. And I don't know that the ash represents anything in particular except what's going to be left. I mean, we have to respond. And I think that holding a small object that has a new altered state brings that very clearly home.
You brought me a couple items. I'm looking at a black charred piece of wood. There's a piece of tile with some bright green leaves painted on it. And there's some melted sort of bottle glass. Tell me more about all three.
Well, that piece of charcoal was part of what held Christie's grandmother's house up. It was probably from a 2x4 that lay on the side of the house. And for some reason, it just occurred to me that I needed to make drawings with that very charcoal. And that's what I did. And the little piece of tile has a clover, which is part of her mother's name, I believe. And the green glass is the blown out windshield from a car that was nearby.
The drawing you did with the charcoal is how many panels? Is it four panels?
It's four panels. It's 7 feet high and 12 feet wide.
It's part of it is on the wall in the gallery. It's enormous. And to think that it was done with the charred wood is really amazing. When you talk about the windshield, there is a photograph, because some of this exhibit is from pictures that you took, of what looks like maybe a white, one of those white vinyl shower curtains kind of melted and flowing down over something. What's that?
It's part of what was left of an automobile. And it might have been a 67 Mustang. I'm not sure. It was in her neighbor's yard. And what it is the melted windshield that must have melted so slowly that it didn't shatter. It just melted right over the steering wheel.
And so turned white?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I know we're focusing on these objects, but you also brought the journal as you walked through the piece of land and the foundations and made notes and took pictures. What was your experience with Christy in doing this? Were there times that she had to stop and kind of catch up to the process of going through everything?
Yes, I would look over and she would be lost in contemplation. She's a deeply intuitive, incredibly bright woman who had this childhood that anybody would envy, hanging out at lakes and fishing with her dad. You know, her mom was really creative. And, you know, I would just, it breaks your heart. We didn't have a lot of time up there. We knew that the cleaners were going to be coming, and in fact, they did. So, you know, we had to just fill up the car, and then we made another trip, and some of it's all gone now.
There are spoons and cups, scissors, jewelry, wrenches, little art pieces, some angels. There's much more in what's in your journal than what's actually on exhibit right now. Mm-hmm. Do you have bigger plans for this?
We would love to install this somewhere else, perhaps a number of places. I think that it causes people to, as you mentioned, for the visitors in the gallery, to actually slow down and take some time and really contemplate what their objects are. One thing I would love to do is to have people email postcards and little notes as to what their object is, because I know I have several. My dad's shaving brush. That's, you know, I keep it because it's got his DNA, his pipe, you know, some of my mom's art. We all have this object, and I would love to hear from people, so we'll probably get that going.
Since the exhibit's gone up, and you've received some feedback, and you hear that these conversations are happening, what have you come to understand? Maybe something that's either surprised you or validated what you believed about putting this project together?
I think how fragile we all are. And I actually got caught over in the very beginnings of the Santa Rosa fire, where the GPS went out, and, you know, I was wandering in my car, stopped by a policeman saying, no, you can't go this way because of downed power lines, how vulnerable we are, and that we have to prepare, we have to make plans, and that will give us a sense that maybe we're a little bit safer, but Sacramento is still the number one flood risk in the nation right now. So these are new realities.
Thank you for bringing this project to us. We posted some pictures on our website, and I really appreciate the conversation. The work you do, Stephanie, continues to amaze and surprise us.
Thank you.
That was artist Stephanie Taylor talking with us in June of 2019. You can find images from the Simple Objects Project at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruriak. Insight is produced by Cody Drabble and Kate Gonzalez. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. We had help from Helen Barrington and Antonio Munez. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.